Tell me what makes the school board important. Why is it important for people to vote in school board elections?
Well, the school board is important because they are the body that is able to take the pulse of the district and to provide oversight for the administrator and the administrators that run the district. It gives the administrators a sounding board, no pun intended, to discuss issues and to bring closure, and it provides a decision-making body for the administration when they get to a point where they want closure on something. The board develops policy, revises policy, listens to the community, tries to, like I said before, take the pulse of the community members, the staff and the students and the parents that work in the district. The board is a conduit, so to speak, can be a conduit for communication from the community. If they see or hear something, you know, or want to know something that they feel that needs to be explored further.
And you joined the school board last year, right?
Yes, last year was the first time. Well, in 2018, I retired from education after 44 years. I was a special education teacher for 32 years and then a special ed director in a neighboring school district for 12 years. I lived in the Caesar Rodney School District all that time. All three of my kids came through Caesar Rodney School District, graduated. I just had education in my soul, in my heart, in my blood, you know, and I wanted to continue to give back. After 44 years, I figured I had a lot of knowledge. I know a lot about education, been in it for all those years. And I figured that somebody sitting on the board that had that background could be helpful when things come up.
Tell me, what are some of the biggest challenges facing your district, and how do you plan on solving those?
That's a heavy question. Obviously, continuing the flow of education during a pandemic is a huge challenge that we've not had to face in 100 years. And 100 years ago, education was not as organized as it is today, so it's really been a blow to the educational system. How do we do this safely? There's a lot of apprehension in the community. There's a lot of apprehension among parents. There's a lot of apprehension among teachers, and rightly so, because there's a lot of unknowns out there about this virus, you know, that we just don't know. So, but there are a lot of knowns as well. You know, if we can get everybody on the same page to follow the safety practices, I think that, you know, people, it would go a long way in making people feel a bit safer about continuing the education process in the best way that we can. Right now, we're looking at the state guidelines that just came out yesterday, and they've got three layers of guidelines depending on the data and what's happening with the virus in Delaware, which I'm really appreciative that they put that out because it helps us to plan. And you know, that's the biggest thing. So we've got a, of course, there's a back to school plan, which would be just normal. And then there's a hybrid plan, which if we are in the current level, if we can stay where we are right now with the transmission of the virus, we'll be able to provide some kind of a hybrid plan where we'll minimize the number of students that are physically in the building every day so that we can actually practice social distancing and monitor masks and things like that. And then, of course, there would be, if it raises higher the rate of transmission, then we'll have to look back into closing schools again and going 100% virtual learning, which is really not good for a lot of kids. You know, it's okay for some. And there might be some that want that anyway, because of, like I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of apprehension in the community. And there may be some parents that would want to opt for that anyway. But we just really won't know until we actually, you know, get rolling and get that communication line going between the parents and the schools. But there is a desire, all the teachers, the kids, everybody wants to get back into school. I mean, there's really no division across that line of thinking. Everyone wants to get back into school. The question is just, how do we do it safely? And then, of course, the second big thing, which we're dealing with right now, is the social justice and the unrest, you know, and the racism, the subconscious biases that we need to pay attention to. We need to look into that. We need to listen to Black Lives Matter. We need to listen to what they are saying, what is happening there, what the feelings are. We need to pay attention to that. We need to listen. We need to tune in, and we need to not prejudge. We need to really listen carefully to those ideas, and we need to develop ways to minimize whatever, you know, the main conclusions that we come to after we have those conversations. We need to work on it. We need to not just sweep it under the rug. We need to definitely, you know, do something about that. And I think the momentum is in the community to have some success there as well. And I'm really interested in that. As a matter of fact, you know, we just added a new position. The board approved at the last board meeting to add a new position to our district called the Equity and Inclusion Coordinator. And this person will focus heavily on that, on the factors around those issues. So those are the two big things, educating remotely during a pandemic and dealing with social justice.
I'm wondering how special education students have fared during the COVID-19 pandemic. How have they dealt with remote learning and adapting to these new changes?
Well, that varies a lot. And yes, it is challenging that as you're well aware, the spectrum of special education goes from students with mild disabilities to students with complex disabilities, with complex needs. So obviously the students with the more complex needs are the ones that have the greatest challenges when it comes to remote learning. I've heard varied levels of success. You know, I've actually had a conversation with one parent frequently who was pretty excited about his nonverbal son with autism that was actually able to communicate somewhat remotely and had some success with one of his therapists online. Of course, it's not the day-to-day, hand-over-hand type of instruction that is really needed to make noticeable progress with our kids with most significant disabilities, but it's those little successes that really that you know you really celebrate, you know, with some of the kids with the most severe disabilities. We're going to have to, you know, we have to somehow make parents and guardians, if 100% remote, which I don't think we're going to be 100% remote. I think there's going to be some kind of a hybrid process, and the kids with the most significant disabilities will be able to still come in because the class, you know, we generally only have 4 or 5 students in a classroom with our kids with the most significant disabilities. So we'll be able to social distance. We'll be able to control the environment around them. And I don't know if I answered your question completely, but the spectrum is broad, and our kids with the least, and I hate to say least significant, like all disabilities are significant, you know, but some are a lot more able to cope with things like remote learning than others. And so I think our kids, you know, they're really more typical than disabled. I like to call them kids with different abilities, you know. And sometimes they really rise to the occasion. We have some kids that have social issues anyway that are loving this online learning. It's really amazing how unique all the kids are and how different they are. We just have to kind of take it on a case by case. We really have to differentiate. We have to differentiate for the needs of our students. One size does not fit all. We've known that forever. And it's really obvious in this kind of environment.
And my last question would be, why should voters choose you over your opponent in the election?
Well, I think they should choose me based, you know, number one, my experience, you know, and I've been in education, like I said before, for 44 years, 45, if you count my extra year on the school board this past year. And I do have a passion for it, a knowledge for it. I'm willing to volunteer my time. I go out and visit the schools. I've got a record of doing that all last year, trying to visit as many of the schools as often as possible. Of course, that came to an abrupt halt in March. But I really have a deep interest. It's in my heart. You know, I have a deep interest in the future of our kids. I feel like I can be a voice for the kids. The kids don't really have a voice, even though we're working on that. They don't get to vote. So I'm an advocate for students. I'm an advocate for staff coming from that. And I feel I know a lot about education and I have a lot to offer.